Swansea. Why is Swansea here? Many settlements are historically located at the mouth of a river or on the banks of one of these, and it's likely to be the original reason. These areas could be defended, and the river mouth provided a natural harbour side for sea trade. Legend has it that the place name is derived from Swain's Eye, a Viking name. Who knows? It's a nice story. The name of the town in Welsh, Abertawe, makes more sense, translated as the mouth of the Tawy. A young six-year-old friend on his first visit saw a swan swimming on the river and the sea in the distance and said, "Swan, sea." So thanks, Isaac. That's as good an explanation for me. Much of the medieval centre of the city was destroyed by bombing in the Second World War. There are castles and some medieval farmhouses outside the city, but in any event, in 1801, the town's population was estimated at a mere 6,000. How did it grow to be considered as a contender for the capital of Wales? Cardiff was declared the nation's capital as recently as 1955, but it had been smaller than Swansea and Merthyr Tydfil for part of the 19th century. It was all down to minerals. Coal exports supported Cardiff's growth to predominance as it had for Merthyr before it, and Swansea's growth was down to metallurgy too. Specifically, copper smelting, with production in the lower Swansea Valley reaching its peak in the early 19th century, when it's claimed that over 60% of the world's copper was produced in the valley and exported from the port. The bizarre fact is that Swansea had no real deposits of copper ore, but the juxtaposition of a number of elements combined to create this industry. Firstly, there were abundant supplies of coal nearby. Secondly, a canal system in the Swansea Valley gave easy transport for the coal. Thirdly, the river and later the port allowed copper ore to be imported by sea. Fourthly, there was a legacy in the area of metal smelting expertise. Finally, some enterprising entrepreneurs identified the opportunities of these elements to take cheap land sites for the works, encourage labour into the area from rural Wales and further afield, and together build an industry of global significance at that time. The imports of copper ore deposits previously coming in relatively small quantities from mines in North Wales and Cornwall were now extended across the globe, reaching out to Spain, Cuba and Chile, amongst others. Exports also went out across the world to meet the growing demand for copper from the new industries such as the railways and telegraph systems. Apart from learning a little bit about this at school, living on the western side of the town away from what had largely become a scene of post-industrial dereliction, I was largely unaware of this during my early years. In fact, the last copper works in Swansea only closed in 1980, although smelting had ended long before that. Despite my relative ignorance, and I'm not alone in this, my life was touched by influences from this industry. On our occasional train journeys in or out of the High Street station, I would see the moonscape that had been left by the industry, and from town you would see the bare hillsides of Kilvey before the replanting in the 1960s, of the Lower Swansea Valley project. We used to visit an old army friend of my father's who lived near the aptly named Chemical Road. I naively thought it was named after a chemist or possibly a chemistry set, popular with children at that time. Closer to home, there were more positive influences. The Vivian family, John Vivian had founded the Havard Copper Works in 1810, gave their name to Vivian Road, where the local library was, and the Vivian Arms pub in Sketty. The Vivians employed the architect Henry Woodyer to design St Paul's Church and the school opposite, known now as the Stuart Hall. And it was here that I went to Cubs and later the Scout Troop, who would regularly attend the church for church parades. Singleton Park, where I spent many hours in childhood, was originally owned by the Vivians and bought by the town council as a public park in 1919. Much of it was developed by Daniel Bliss, who had trained at Kew Gardens. The lower part of the park now has Singleton Hospital and Swansea University, with their administration housed in Singleton Abbey, built as Merino in 1784. bought by the Vivians in 1817. Today the city has started to celebrate its industrial history again, with restoration works taking place at the Havard Morford Copperworks site. Kilvey Hill is green again, and the River Towey has clean water with the river barrage, which has allowed river traffic and a marina. I should also say that Swansea is a city, and has been since 1969, but I always think of it as a town, and still refer when going there as going into town. In common with other towns and cities during my lifetime, there have been enormous social and physical changes. Most of these changes are not unique to my town, although some characteristics and past events of the location have influenced the changes. Nostalgia is a very strong human emotion, and there is some kind of safety valve in the human memory that yearns for the good things in the past, while subconsciously glossing over the negative aspects, so that the past is often viewed through a rosy positive tint. It's quite common today for people to look at their cities and high streets and lament that traffic was never this bad, people were more smartly dressed and courteous, and that good quality shopping could be found in all high streets. The same people will be families of multiple car ownership and would balk at having to put on a collar and tie to go to a restaurant. The view is that this vibrant centre has been replaced by characterless chain stores with indifferent staff, often in bleak out-of-town retail parks and charity shops, nail bars and other non-essential retail has all replaced useful shops in the city centres. In some ways I agree, in that I remember the town centre in the 50s and 60s, when parking was easy, or buses were frequent, and all shopping from a new school blazer to fresh food and a puppy or a hamster could be found in the centre. People were smartly dressed, but the baby boomer generation have only ourselves to blame for the decline in dress standards, having eagerly discarded the collar and tie, embracing jeans and more relaxed leisure wear, culminating in smart casual, followed by very casual, judging by the lunchtime exodus from offices near me. This is not new, and I'm sure the Victorian generation were horrified by the 20th century. My generation's nostalgia for the vibrant city centre of the 60s is only an echo of the previous generation, who enjoyed a bustling pre-war Swansea town centre. Quoting from the excellent Rebuilding Swansea, 1941 to 1961, by Dinah Evans, published by the West Glamorgan Archive Service, an official survey in 1936 of the town identified a 2-acre covered market with over 400 shops and stalls, as well as 10 department stores, 51 multiple shops, 13 cooperative stores, and almost a further 3,000 individual shops, covering the complete range of goods and services. Some of the facilities described in Swansea stores pre-war would have not been out of place in Knightsbridge or New York. They included a Viennese roof garden with sea views, a rooftop track for petrol-driven children's cars, full-size electric funfair-style roundabout, and the Ben Evans store had four stories, including amongst their attractions a restaurant, a gentleman's smoking room, a ladies' writing room, and their afternoon fashion shows to be watched while taking tea. Possibly the most ambitious was in the pre-war David Evans store on Goat Street, which in 1933 created an in-house Indian village. This was hosted by staff from the Indian subcontinent in traditional dress. The display included a carpet shop, an arts and crafts bazaar, and a scale model of the Taj Mahal, as well as a temple, a prayer room, an Indian theatre. The madness culminated in a jungle room with scampering monkeys and a huge stuffed Bengal tiger. These were certainly pre-political correctness days. There's no mention of elephants, so they must have realised that extravagance has its limits. So nostalgia for past glory seems to be an entitlement for each generation. It remains to be seen if future generations will lament the passing of out-of-town malls, traffic jams, and tattoo and nail parlours. Already the nostalgia exists for crowded, dirty, smoky pubs, serving warm beer and not much else. Still, this is meant to be an affectionate look back to my childhood, so I'd better tone this down. The truth is that each generation's advances bring changes, some that are more welcome than others, and it's always difficult to retain perspective when trying to achieve a balanced conclusion. In some ways, the city or town of Swansea has always suffered from an identity crisis. Is it a tourist centre on the fringe of the first designated area of outstanding natural beauty in the UK? And if so, why is there a dearth of decent hotel accommodation and no office of tourist information, unlike any other decent tourist city? There's precious little recognition of the potential claim of the Lower Swansea Valley to be the seat of the Industrial Revolution, with worldwide trade and integrated metallurgy production in the late 17th and 18th century. Its focus as a regional shopping and trading centre from Victorian times has suffered in recent decades, and the reinvention as a university city has certainly proved controversial in some quarters. The coming of containerisation in shipping has helped to put the city docks into a decline, with the traffic there a fraction today of what it was at its peak. Maybe our geographical location, which had such advantages for earlier developments, is now proving an inherent disadvantage, common to second cities in many other countries. You often heard lament of, that will just go to Cardiff, just 40 miles up the road, but 40 miles closer to Westminster. Recent developments in the city, as I must remember to call it, it was made a city over 50 years ago, have given me cause for optimism. Yes, there is more traffic and the shops in the centre no longer supply all needs, but we have internet shopping and out-of-town retail. Town centres everywhere are having to reinvent themselves, and Swansea's no different. There are efforts by the City Council to encourage much new development, and these are to be celebrated. The number of students is a cause for celebration, bringing diversity, youth and spending into the centre. Capitalising on the waterfront opportunities offered by the coast, as well as the river and docklands, is another welcome development. The availability of brownfield sites near the city centre allow new housing, leisure and service developments. The past is another place. You can't go back there. So we must look to the future and embrace the changes. This location of a city by the sea has a lot to offer both now and in the future. Postscript. This series of early life memories was written at a time, to use an overused but appropriate phrase, of unprecedented challenges to the world through the 2020 global pandemic. My childhood years were characterised by a different set of fears, usually relating to the outbreak of an armed conflict culminating in a world war. Given at the time of my birth, it was just over 5 years since the Second World War had been dramatically ended by the dropping of two atomic bombs by the Americans on the Japanese civilian populations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, with hundreds of thousands of deaths immediately and in the aftermath, it's not surprising that this was a time of fear. The nations of the world were engaged in expensive military arms races, and flashpoints had recently occurred in Korea, the Middle East and Eastern Europe. As I entered secondary school, the Cuban Missile Crisis brought the two great world powers at that time to the brink of nuclear conflict. Thankfully, it was averted. The fear of nuclear war was replaced on the brink of my teenage years by anxieties over the 11 plus and whether I would go to the same school as my friends. The fears were to prove groundless, but all that came later. Unfortunately, the pandemic of the last 18 months was not averted, and for all of us, this period has seen our lives changed in ways that would have been thought to have been a science fiction film script. Fortunately, the more extreme scenarios of looting and food riots appear to have been largely avoided. It's interesting that lockdowns in the USA provoked a rush to buy firearms, whilst in this country there was a rush on toilet paper. It's difficult to work out who is the most frightened by the crisis. All of that apart, it's been a strange year. And for my own part, I want to record the impact of the pandemic on my life, much of it no doubt trivial. Firstly, although the media had carried stories of a virus in China since early in 2020, we spent Christmas on holiday in Lisbon and been away seeing friends in Sussex and later to Mid Wales in January. We had a week booked for the beginning of March in a hotel in the Algarve in Portugal, and at the time of the holiday saw no reason to cancel it. Some 6 weeks or so later, we expected to travel to the Greek island of Crete, to our little holiday home there, where we usually spent a few weeks each spring and autumn. The day we flew to Portugal, the UK had only announced 3 COVID-related deaths of people returning to the country with links to outbreaks abroad. The first death was announced 4 days before we flew. That week, the Cheltenham Festival took place normally, with over 250,000 people mixing freely. It has since been described as a super spreader event. In Liverpool, 3,000 Spanish fans flew in for the Liverpool versus Atletico Madrid cup tie. In Portugal and at the airports, all seemed normal, with no masks in sight, and in the hotel, we were the only people we saw using hand sanitizer. But given we were all helping ourselves to hot and cold food from buffet dishes, this was probably ineffective. Media coverage on the TV news escalated during the week, with alarming footage of hospital scenes in Italy and Spain, as well as the situation in Wuhan, China. We arrived back into the UK on the night of the 13th to 14th of March, with the announcements that the FA was suspending the Premier League season, local elections were postponed, and after the first UK hospital had announced a critical emergency due to being overwhelmed by COVID cases. It started to feel a different world to the one we'd left to go on holiday. Within days, the closure of non-essential shops, pubs and restaurants were announced, and in short order, more restrictions were announced. Working from home, travel restrictions, only 1 hour's exercise near home, and face masks, etc. The immediate priority was food deliveries. We've been having deliveries at home for some time from one of the supermarkets, but despite being a regular customer, no slots are available. So not wishing to mix inside, I scouted online for some click and collect slots from any supermarket that was available, and luckily booked one for later that week. Other measures and the daily Downing Street bad news press conferences are familiar to many of us, so I won't cover them here. Our own lives closed down. No visitors to the house, an hour's exercise a day outside, keeping our distance from strangers and neighbours alike, shopping online for everything. The Zoom video conferencing app became a way of seeing others, the spraying of post and parcels and vigorous washing of hands with the fear of going to a hospital if any other health issue arose. The hearing about a few friends and acquaintances being tested positively for COVID, the country grinding to a halt and the news channel being dominated by this one story and life closing down. We were fortunate as our lives are less affected than for many others. The deaths and illnesses of loved ones, the isolation for many people, the occurrence of long COVID illnesses, the impact on education, careers and livelihoods was terrible for many, and it affected everyone to a greater or lesser extent. Life is no different. The brief and nervous respite of the summer and tentative outings and brief stays in COVID-secure hotels in Wales before the second lockdown, and a very isolated Christmas and the aftermath. The relief of vaccinations recently hasn't given me enough confidence to regularly go back into supermarkets just yet. Writing this reminds me of a childhood anecdote, often repeated by my mum, who answered the door one day to a boy living down the road from us. His opening comment was a little mystifying to her. "Can I see them?" "Pardon," answered Mum. "The chickens. I've come to see Jeff's chickens." "What chickens?" "I've heard Jeff has chickens in a box." I was in bed upstairs with chicken pox. Mystery solved. Living in Wales, as some of the powers and regulations devolve, we frequently find ourselves shouting at the radio or television, "In England!" when national restrictions were announced. But this only added another layer of confusion to what and where and when we could do things. We felt fortunate to have travelled so frequently in previous years, but in some senses it made us feel the loss of freedom more acutely. We knew we were lucky not to have the worry of careers or more elderly parents in care homes. We were also aware we were now, because of an age and some pre-existing health conditions, in a vulnerable and at-risk category. Like many of our contemporaries, we hunkered down. I'd like to end the book on a positive note, so I've captured some photos that I've used and will appear in the book. And I also give thanks to my parents, Joan and Lou, for my happy upbringing, and to my wife for her enthusiastic support in my writing, and most of all, being here with me in the present. I've enjoyed trawling through my memories for these stories and hope to add to them with later memories of my teenage years.